Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, June 10th, 2015. Lots of corporate power is at the table in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's time for a little, Once again, WikiLeaks has pierced the veil of corporate secrecy surrounding the negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I'm really grateful to WikiLeaks for daring to gather information and share it with the public. And I want to begin by noting that the New York Times, mouthpiece for corporate America, has now upgraded WikiLeaks to the term watchdog group. I find this quite amusing because the Times and other corporate media outlets have been very happy to take the fruits of WikiLeaks' efforts, going back to Chelsea Manning's disclosures, many other important documents that have been made public by Julian Assange, who is still holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, fearing that the U.S. will extradite him and lock him up and stop WikiLeaks from leaking. So to see the Times call WikiLeaks a watchdog group, I found amusing and delightful, actually. So here is the deal. You know that the Senate has approved Fast Track, not only for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but as it turns out, for two other deals, an Atlantic deal and an international agreement about the use of the Internet. That one's called TISA, T-I-S-A. And the fast-track power that the Senate approved extends for a six-year period, which means that all three of these trade deals that are in the pipeline but are labeled secret and that the corporate media generally avoids reporting on could be approved under the fast-track authority anytime over the next six-year period. And so this exposure of the chapter of the agreement and the latest draft of the deal related to pharmaceutical interests is quite fascinating. And, of course, once again, it pits the interests of you and me against big corporations and the multinational pharmaceutical giants. So this is called an annex to the TPP. And the Times opens its story by saying, facing resistance from its Pacific trading partners, the Obama administration is no longer demanding protection for pharmaceutical prices under the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, let's pause here for a moment and look at the pattern of Barack Obama's behavior. Because the other notable place where the Obama administration caved into Big Pharma is in Obamacare, where the law explicitly states that the government can't negotiate with the big pharmaceutical companies to get bulk discounts and reduce the cost of drugs for the people who buy coverage under Obamacare, and this relates to Medicare as well. So the pattern is that Obama supports Big Pharma over the interests of the American middle class when it comes to being able to afford important medications. So opponents of both the Pacific deal and the fast-track legislation have long targeted the pharmaceutical issue. Foreign governments and healthcare activists have accused the giants, the pharma companies, of protecting profits over public health. That, my friends, is an understatement. And it turns out that the little Kiwi nation of New Zealand is the one that's pushing back the hardest at the TPP table, because New Zealand has a powerful system for holding down drug costs, and it keeps the drug makers in the dark. So, thank you, New Zealand, because you may be able to rescue us from a bad deal being negotiated in secret where the corporations have clearly the upper hand. So, this leaked document, dated December 17th of last year, explicitly lists Medicare and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services as falling under its jurisdiction. And in the event of disputes, these would not be settled in American courts, not be settled at the United Nations, for example. The annex makes clear that disputes over pharmaceutical listing procedures would be resolved through the investor-state dispute settlement process, which involves three lawyer extrajudicial tribunals organized under rules set by the UN or the World Bank. They don't appear to be in place now. But this takes it beyond the power of our legal system. And it raises the fears of many about world government and, you know, losing our autonomy. And these are very serious issues because our standard of living, our first world status, could be deeply eroded by litigation at these secret tribunals that could undermine American law, regulation, environmental protections, restrictions on the use of tobacco. Those are just some examples. And over at Public Citizen, where Lori Wallach and her team have been monitoring these events very carefully, one of her colleagues, Peter Mabarduke, issued this statement. This leak reveals that the Obama administration, acting at the behest of pharmaceutical companies, has subjected Medicare to a series of procedural rules negotiated in secret that would limit Congress' ability to enact policy reforms that would reduce prescription drug costs for Americans and might even open to challenge aspects of our health care system today. So these are very, very serious issues. Barack Obama, the guy who promised us the most transparent administration in history. This is hardly transparent. And it's one thing to do all this in secret, and we start to get a glimpse of why they do it in secret when you see the terms of this stinky deal. We'll continue to cover the issues related to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. By the way, friends, I have to tell you that construction continues on the building where the secret studio is located. And so you may hear some noises in the background. Fortunately, the guys don't have the jackhammers out today. But I do apologize for any noise you hear in the background here. So President Obama, again, with a truthiness problem. The guy who said he wouldn't commit American ground troops to his new war in Iraq and to any possible future efforts in Syria, has added another 450 American troops to Iraq. That brings us to 3,450 and counting. And this is a pointless mission. These new advisors, quote, will work to build capacity of Iraqi forces, including local tribal fighters. Well, we know this is bullshit, because in a weak moment, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter blurted out that Iraqi forces aren't willing to fight. And so we can train them and spend our money and send advisors and do all that stuff. But essentially, the Iraqis want the U.S. to return to their country and fight this war for them. And then what do? We still have a fractured country there, partitioned along Sunni, Kurdish, Shia lines. And the competing alliances, whether it's with the Islamic State and the Sunni radicals, or the Shiite-dominated Iranian factions. This is a lose-lose situation. And Obama's not leveling with us, not only about how long it might take to roust the Islamic State, but these moves that are being made are described as a new approach in the headline in the New York Times. And then we get this statement from the Defense Department. This does not represent a change in mission, but rather adds another location for the Department of Defense to conduct similar activities in more areas in Iraq. So they're going to open a new training location. But this will not change the dynamic there. And we also have decided to send arms and equipment to the Iraqi government for it to distribute to Sunni fighters. And we know that the Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad will continue to pull its punches. And so this is just such a series of Hobson's choices. There are no good choices. But that does not mean, in the absence of good choices, that we just reflexively continue to build up troop levels. And, of course, when one or more of those troops gets kidnapped and beheaded or is somehow, drawn into enemy fire, that will become the pretext for putting massive numbers of U.S. boots on the ground in Iraq and potentially Syria. And of course, since Congress has failed to pass any parameters in the form of a war powers resolution, the Obama administration can do whatever it wants. It has a blank check here. And Congress has pumped more money into the Pentagon budget so that that blank check actually has some serious funds it can draw on. And now comes Navy Rear Admiral John Kirby, who is one of the spokespersons at the State Department. And following up on Obama's comments yesterday that the U.S. doesn't have a complete strategy for training Iraqi security forces, he says, well, it could take at least 3 to 5 years for Iraq to overcome the Islamic State. Asked if the current strategy is working, Kirby said, well, maybe the way we're going about that needs to be changed a little bit. Kirby said the U.S. and its allies could go all in, but also said that even if the problem is viewed in only a military context, it's still going to take 3 to 5 years. It's not going to happen overnight. Obama hasn't told us that. I mean, I really hated Richard Nixon's war planning and the moves that he made after he became president in Vietnam. But he routinely went on television. He didn't talk about the secret wars in Cambodia and Laos. But he did communicate with the American people, as did LBJ before him. And Obama thinks we don't care. It's kind of whatever, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, you know, I mean, it's all over there and we just don't care. I mean, for God's sake, the NBA playoffs are underway and they're pretty exciting. So this complex, and forgive me if my language offends you, but I can't think of any better word than clusterfuck to describe what's going on in Syria. And the Hezbollah fighters who came in from Lebanon, and they support the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad. They, of course, are aligned with Iran. They're now guarding the border between Syria and Lebanon. And they repelled Daesh extremists in a battle that occurred in the last couple of days near the border village of Ras Baalbek. At least 5 Islamic State fighters were killed or wounded, including the group's alleged leader. And this just shows that we have a situation that is completely out of control. And the idea that we can train Iraqi forces to repel the Islamic State, that there's some moderates in Syria that we can train up, and they'll be good enough to kill the Daesh fighters, but not so evil like Daesh that we can't control them after the fighting ends. It is sheer madness. I can't think of another way to describe it. And meanwhile, Islamic State militants staged attacks near Baghdad and the Libyan city of Sirte on Tuesday. And we're going to train more Iraqis. Yeah, that'll fix it. Well, there's a photo that surfaced today, tweeted out by John Kerry from the hospital where he's staying in Boston. And it shows him recovering from surgery, and he's got his broken right leg up on an ottoman or something like that. And it's the first time we've seen a picture of him since the bike accident in Geneva, Switzerland on May 31st. And in the interim, I've seen some wild postings on the internet that the bike accident was actually an assassination attempt. People blame the Islamic State in these wild postings that I've read. I see no proof for that. But I also don't see why the State Department essentially had a 10-day blackout on information and photographs of John Kerry, kind of fed the crazies out there. In an interesting move, the European Union is preparing new guidelines that will require Israel to label products made in West Bank settlements if they're exported to the 28 nations of the European Union. It's the latest sign of international discontent with Israeli construction of settlements in the occupied territories. And it is a major setback for Israel, where officials reject this plan, saying it would amount to a type of boycott No. It would allow people to choose not to buy products made in occupied West Bank communities by Israelis or by Israeli companies, even some that employ Palestinian workers. And this comes on the heels of the battle against boycott, divestment, and sanction here in the United States, the recent effort at FIFA to expel Israel or suspend them from the International Soccer League. We have the episode where the French phone company, Orange, partly owned by the state government, said it wants to pull out of Israel. And its CEO, at least in the comments I read after a firestorm, said, this is just consolidating our business, and it doesn't have anything to do with the BDS movement. But it was interpreted that way. And today I'm releasing a powerful interview with a Palestinian named Baha Hilo. I actually spoke to Baha by phone many years ago, and yesterday he came to the secret studio and had an opportunity to have a great conversation with him. And he's a fascinating, articulate, intelligent, very well-informed guy. He's not particularly aligned with Fatah or Hamas. He's not into politics. But in our conversation, he describes the daily humiliation that Palestinians endure under the Israeli rule in the West Bank. And it's quite detailed, very moving to hear it. And toward the end of our conversation, we're joined by Marietta Macy, who is one of the coordinators for the Presbyterian Church's outreach on the BDS movement. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Baha Hilo, where he talks about the separate but equal, the segregation policies imposed by Israel on the daily lives of Palestinians.
Now, inside the West Bank, Israel has been, or the state of Israel has been, encouraging Israeli civilians to go live in land that the state has already confiscated off Palestinians, mm-hmm. that the state has already built housing units for Israeli Jews only to live inside the West Bank, that the state of Israel has sponsored almost every single aspect of the life of those Israelis inside the West Bank. When we speak about, for instance, apartheid inside Palestine, we are talking about one territory like the West Bank has two laws. One law that Israeli civil law that's superior to the Israeli military law imposed on the Palestinian population there. There are two sets of laws. It's how things they are. One is superior and one is inferior. So this is why the state of Israel gives itself the right to actually do whatever they want. Controlling water is one thing. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I would say, difficult for people to understand that the state of Israel is in control of how much water we drink. So there are Israeli Jewish-only communities, settlements, colonies, whatever term you like to use, on one hilltop besides Palestinian community.
And let me stop you for a second, because mm. the impression that many Americans have mm. of these Jewish settlements mm. are like camps, you mm. know, that they're camping out and they have mm. tents and this is temporary and, you know, they're just going to be there until they move on to something permanent. But yep. when I see the pictures, these are huge, massive developments with, you know, townhouses, condominiums stacked mm-hmm. up. Often with a wall or other security system to enclose it, and so they really are creating what in the U.S. we used to call segregation mm-hmm. or separate but equal.
You would say like gated communities. In fact, separate but equal is a common sense in the state of Israel. They mm-hmm. want to separate themselves from the Palestinians rather than from Palestine. They just want to get rid of the population and then say, well, we are separate but equal.
I invite you to listen to the full interview. It's an in-depth conversation with Baha Hilo, released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And you can find it at Stitcher, at TuneIn, and the other outlets, including iTunes, where you pick up the Peter B. Collins podcasts. And I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions. Gary Washington, Tom Burkhart just renewed his annual subscription. Julie Dupree does more than she has to. Steve Lane, is a monthly subscriber. I'd like you to join them, and I really need your help these days. Things are tight here at the Peter B. Collins shop, and I would love it if you would sign up for a new subscription. You can go to my website, peterbcollins.com. You click on the sign-up link. It's right under my picture on the homepage. And from there, you get to choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers anywhere in the world earn a bonus gift, the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest book of his columns called Empire of Chaos. Well, on the face of it, this is an interesting positive move. John McCain, the Republican, and Senator Feinstein, the Democrat, are teaming up to introduce a measure to limit U.S. government use to limit the U.S. government to the use of interrogation techniques specified in the Army Field Manual. And this is an effort to ban torture. And as you know, I fully support the concept. And McCain has been all over the map. As a victim of torture in North Vietnam, he has from time to time spoken out against torture. But when that was inconvenient, like when he was running for president in 2008 and needed George W. Bush's support, well, he slipped it into his sneakers. So this McCain-Feinstein amendment would codify into law an executive order signed by Obama in 2009 that made it illegal for the U.S. government to engage in torture, and that would prevent any future president from reversing the executive order that Obama signed. Now, I'm relying on a single news story here, and so the bill may be more detailed than what I am learning from this news account, but it doesn't appear to have any teeth. They're not describing here punishments for officials who authorize torture or for individual soldiers, CIA officers, contractors, or others who actually perform torture techniques. And so, great, outlaw it, but it's already illegal. And what we saw was the Bush administration got lawyers like John Yoo to redefine torture in a way that tortured language and rational thinking. And then they just went ahead and did it, and Obama covered it up by refusing to prosecute anyone under the existing laws that ban torture. And so I have to say that on first blush, this just appears to be a PR technique or a PR statement. And in an op-ed published in today's San Francisco Chronicle, Juan Mendez, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Cruel and Inhumane Treatment, speaks up, and he's essentially shaming the United States over our diminished stature in the world because we are known as a nation that commits torture. Despite the fact that we were signed to the UN Convention Against Torture, and the radical president who signed us into that convention was Ronald Reagan. And at issue is the pending deportation or extradition of a Mexican national, Jose Luis Munoz Santos. And they use the name Munoz as a surname. If he's extradited, he might face torture himself in violation of the human rights standard, the prohibition against returning a person to a country where he would face torture. And this case is before the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the formerly super liberal appeals court here in San Francisco. And Mendez writes, a court ruling that sends Munoz back to Mexico without addressing the allegations of torture would be a big step in exactly the wrong direction. The case may not be generating major headlines, but believe me, other governments are watching. If the United States allows his extradition, it will violate the prohibition on using evidence produced by torture. And this will lead to wider acceptance of violations of the Convention Against Torture around the world. And here's his final sentence. Actually, two sentences. This much is certain. The U.S. government is a global leader on torture. Whether it is anti-torture or pro-torture leader is the question. In another court ruling, The uber-conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans is defying the United States Supreme Court and has upheld most of the draconian and obviously unconstitutional elements of the new state laws about abortion clinics in Texas. And these are the laws that require essentially a hospital-like setting, requires that the abortion doctor has admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, and of course that's not possible because the state has also passed laws that allow hospitals to deny access privileges to these abortion doctors. And so these are simply obstacles that the Texas legislature has placed in front of women who want an abortion. They're clearly unconstitutional, and that's why, in the past, the Supreme Court sent this ruling back to the Fifth Circuit Court and told them to get it right. And we have a serious showdown underway in this country about abortion rights, and the Democrats have checked out. They don't see it as a winning issue for them anymore. And many women are going to be hurt by this, now and for a long time to come. In another bad court ruling, yesterday we were expecting the release of Alfred Woodfox from custody in Louisiana, where he's been held at the brutal Angola prison for over 40 years. He has spent 40 years in the hole, in solitary confinement. And a federal appeals court put a hold on the ruling from a trial court judge who had concluded that the state can't fairly try Woodfox, age 68, a third time for the killing of a prison guard 43 years ago, and that the only just remedy would be setting him free after all the years he spent in extended lockdown. Now, Woodfox has long maintained his innocence in the guard's killing, but of course facts don't matter when you're a black man in prison in Louisiana. And the federal appeals court that blocked his release, this action was viewed by supporters as retribution for Woodfox's Black Panther Party activism to protest the prison conditions there at Angola. A shocking report about veterans who commit suicide, and we know that this has become a very serious problem since the war in Iraq. It afflicts women, female combat veterans, at a rate 6 times higher than men. This is deeply disturbing. The data is based on 173,000 adult suicides, men and women, veterans and non-veterans, in 23 states between 2000 and 2010. And for women ages 18 to 29, veterans kill themselves at nearly 12 times the rate of non-veterans. Oh, all those people who still have their "We Support the Troops" bumper stickers, they're missing in action when it comes to supporting our veterans. And finally today, a salute to the Raging Grannies of Seattle. 6 of them were detained by police on Tuesday during a protest to block access to the Royal Dutch Shell drilling rig that is moored in the Seattle harbor these days. It is rumored to be leaving for the Arctic as soon as today. And the activists are gearing up to shadow this drilling rig when Shell decides to try to move it. I love the name of the group. Shell No is the protest umbrella group. And this polar pioneer could be moving north as early as today. So activists say they want to launch boats once they learn the rig is leaving. Now, the Coast Guard has imposed a safety zone of 100 yards. And then once they get into Puget Sound, they have to stay at least 500 yards away from the drilling rig. So I really appreciate the work of these protesters. They have been at it for a month to 5 weeks now. And I think that they're making some very important statements for you and me and most Americans. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. This is the free podcast that you're free to distribute to absolutely everyone. So get going on that, will you? I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.